Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Kachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Kachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's kachava.com, code NEWS.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everyone. It's a new week, but it doesn't really feel like it. Things are dragging on and not seemingly improving that much in the world of aviation. Yeah, right, Alex?
Yeah, this is definitely having, you know, I think people are quite aware now this is having global and a truly global impact across aviation, extending right out into everything that aviation touches, including tourism and travel, hospitality and whatnot. We have airlines running to rewrite their financial forecasts and outlook for the next 6 months. There are airlines that are making big decisions to cut capacity that is affected or linked to the Middle East. But also, I mean, this just flagged up now, and this is worth mentioning, given that it's so current. And just for the record, we are recording on Wednesday this morning, European time. So this episode will be in your feeds shortly after our recording. So we're as current as can be. Thai Airways have said, Dan, that they will raise all ticket prices by up to 15% to offset the surging fuel cost as the state-owned carrier grapples with overwhelming demand from customers who are shifting their plans away from the Middle East but still need a way to travel either between Thailand in Europe or elsewhere in Asia via Bangkok to Europe. There are so many different angles to this crisis, but I think what's become really relevant over the last few days in terms of public awareness is the price of oil, right, and fuel.
Precisely. Well, there's two questions that we're getting a lot. Two different versions of the same thing. The first is, if I'm scheduled to fly through the Middle East in March, for example, what should I do? What should I think about? What should I prepare for? And the other is, if I'm scheduled to travel long haul at all in March, is that even a good idea? What should I think of then? And those are obviously both very valid questions.
Definitely. So March, we are already 11 days in. I feel it has flown because of the way that the conflict has kind of encapsulated this time so far. I think for anyone with a long haul booking that is east of Europe. So let's talk specifically first about let's assume a European market with long haul bookings east. So anywhere from Middle East to Asia, the Far East, Australia, and so on. There will be a significant portion of those bookings that would have typically have traveled via the Middle East, which seemingly may be able to in a week or so, or even in a limited capacity later this week, but it is shrouded in uncertainty. And for most passengers, for most people, I get it. That uncertainty is just too much. Many of these people that have written into us are saying that they have been waiting and preparing and saving up. And these trips were booked 10 months ago, a year ago. And so the timing is horrible because the last thing they want now is to be refreshing the airline app right up until check-in time to figure out if their flight is actually going or even if that second connecting flight will be operating. So airlines are establishing some refund and flexible booking policies that cover most of March. And these are the Gulf carriers that are predominantly doing this, meaning that if you are, for example, not traveling in the next 5 days or the next 10 days, but perhaps late March, most of the carriers are introducing or are beginning to extend that policy so that either you can cash out entirely or you can rebook for another date. But the problem with cashing out entirely, as you know, Dan, is that good luck trying to find an additional option that is anywhere near to or close to the price that you had originally paid, right?
Yeah, 100%. We spoke about that in our previous episode. It's basically impossible. And that's the problem, that the capacity that's omitted from the market by the Middle Eastern airlines cannot be compensated. It's been interesting to see which airlines are adding additional frequencies. Obviously, this is very difficult. We're on the tail end of the IATA winter season, and generally during the winter season, airlines are utilizing their long-haul aircraft specifically quite a bit less than they do in the summer. So potentially for the coming weeks, there is some spare capacity there. We've seen the likes of British Airways start flights, temporary flights between Heathrow and Bangkok. So they normally fly from Gatwick. Now they're adding flights from Heathrow to Bangkok. We've seen Cathay Pacific put in extra frequencies. We've seen Air Canada, specifically to London for Cathay Pacific, Air Canada doubling their flights to certain Indian destinations out of Canada, because they would have put a lot of people through the Gulf hubs previously. Norse Atlantic, I think, also increasing certain frequencies to Southeast Asia. So certain airlines are trying to, let's say, help out, to be kind. But of course, this is a fantastic revenue opportunity for Western airlines or Asian airlines, even as oil prices increase. The real tricky question is, first of all, if you are traveling through the Middle East throughout March, I think at this point it's very clear that you should be making some sort of backup plan if you can. The real question is, and we often talk about how, you know, in the UK especially, when the media talks about flying and air travel, it's always framed as, oh, your holiday. They never acknowledge that business travel is a big part of that. And that's totally true. Business travel is very important. As we saw during COVID, business travel can be done remotely. So there are ways that, let's say a business traveler going on a 2-3 day long haul trip might want to consider if that can be done remotely, just because there is a risk. Let's say that your Thai Airways flight or your British Airways flight is canceled due to technical issues or something. You might not be able to get a seat home to be rebooked on another airline for a long time, leaving you potentially stranded on a short trip. Same thing, of course, goes for a vacation. Because just speaking from personal experience, I know when my Swedish relatives, for example, are going on a vacation, to them it's very like, well, yeah, you know, we'll see if that, they're very chill about it for some reason. So I know a lot of people view their vacations as, oh, it'll happen. I don't really care where it is. I just want to go somewhere sunny and that's enough for me. Then if you have the option to look at going somewhere closer to home, perhaps in Europe, or if you live in Asia, staying in Asia, that's also a way to minimize the potential risks you're taking. And it's horrible for people who are, you know, completely unaffected by what's going on to have to reconsider their plans as well. But I think just from a minimizing things that could go wrong perspective, this is a time where it might be good to look closer to home if you have options to avoid any risk.
You're right. And as I say, as you touched on just now, it is that uncertainty that is there. Aaron has written in to ask us, what are the three big Gulf carriers that are responsible for the sheer volume of global air traffic that we outlined in the last episode? That's sometimes up to 500,000 a day in terms of what they're handling as hubs, Doha, Dubai, Abu Dhabi. Aaron is asking if we can outline what the three carriers are doing in terms of their policies during this current war. So the quick rundown is that for all three carriers, Qatar, Etihad and Emirates, the refund eligibility option has been in place since the 28th of Feb when war had broken out. They have different timelines, though. So, for example, Emirates is currently the longest. You are able to refund if you were booked to travel any time until the 31st of March. Qatar, a tiny bit shorter. It's until the 22nd of March currently. I understand that's extending. and Etihad the 21st of March, a little bit behind Qatar. The rebook deadlines are different depending on when your flight was supposed to be. But crucial information here is that you can get a refund, and they are actively processing refunds, some better than others. I'm hearing some negative sentiment regarding Etihad and the way that they are processing refunds. They had actually taken the feature off of the online capability to be able to refund online, forcing people to call. And I understand that calling was almost not an option because of their sheer volume, and they're suffering what's being quoted as a call center collapse, which many carriers are facing as well. Gulf Air in that same category. But they you can get refunds from these carriers. And I understand that many also will be looking, as this seemingly kind of drags on, at options that they introduced during COVID, whereby you were able to keep the money in the airline and obtain a credit voucher that was of a higher value than what you had originally paid. We saw many airlines pivot to that during COVID as a way to preserve cash, but to also give the passenger peace of mind over a longer period of time, that if you have a booking, let's say over the next 3 to 6 months, keep your money in the airline, but cash out with a voucher plus 10 or 15% more of the original value of your ticket, meaning that you can spend that another time with that airline. Now, of course, you might not want to, and understandably so. It is very unclear as to when this is going to end, how, and so on. And there are mixed messages coming from the guy in the White House. We won't touch on that too much. But the other little part that is linked with this question that I wanted to answer, and Natasha has asked this by DM, but also many others have asked the same question, is what happens if the flight is actually cancelled by the airline? What obligation does the airline have? So this is really, really crucial, and I want to spell this out, because now that we are so many days into the crisis, airlines are way more kind of on their feet in terms of their proactiveness here than they were when the crisis first struck. And here's what I mean. If, for example, one of these Gulf carriers has cancelled your flights, let's say between Europe and the Maldives, and it's two flights and they've cancelled, when you open that up in their mobile app, for example, theoretically, the option will be there immediately to refund, and you can cash out. And that's where your relationship with the airline surrounding this booking finishes. If you accept a refund, they no longer have any further obligation. What I want to remind is that in almost all scenarios, the airline still does have an obligation to get you to your destination, especially if there are alternative routes, even if it means rebooking on a competitor airline that the airline has no obligation with. And finally, now that we are, 12, 13 days into this crisis, we are seeing very positive sentiment on forums like Reddit, who are accurately sharing their experiences one by one in what they're calling rerouting success, right? So they were booked on, for example, Qatar to go to the Maldives, and they, through speaking with an agent on the live chat, for example, have been able to see that because their flight was cancelled, they were rebooked the whole thing on Turkish Airlines. Turkish Airlines is a competitor of Qatar. It has no working relationship, but Qatar is fulfilling its obligation there by doing so. Emirates have been praised tremendously for the way that they were proactively rebooking and rerouting on any other carriers, whoever was available in the market, from the moment the crisis had struck. So there's limited evidence that Etihad is being as proactive, but again, they're facing a bit of an extended issue there. It's something to be aware of. In some scenarios, if you can be flexible about it, it's worth waiting for the airline to cancel the flight if it's not going to operate, because then you can start the conversation with them as to, okay, how are you planning on getting me there? Can I propose to you, for example, this American Airlines flight or this flight that is via Ethiopian Airlines and Addis Ababa? And there is documented evidence everywhere that that is happening. And I would recommend that listeners have that in their head if they do have bookings over the coming weeks.
Yeah. I mean, what you say is valid in terms of waiting to see if the flight is canceled and then getting better refund options. Of course, it's risky to assume your trip will go ahead if you reach that point. Do you think that, as I said, travelers should sort of get comfortable with the idea that their trip might not be happening unless they make backup plans now or schedule to do something else, at least for the coming month?
It's a difficult question, isn't it? Because it's how each individual person is going to perceive the uncertainty or the risk of closures. I mean, I note that just Dubai Airport this morning, which Dubai is quite determined to keep declaring that they are back to normal. And for what it's worth, none of these airlines right now are anywhere near to normal. In fact, many of them are operating on less than 10% of their regular flight operations. To put this into perspective for you, so let's look at the numbers. So just before the crisis had struck, so the day before, the 27th of February, Emirates had operated 531 flights on the 27th of February, 531. On the 3rd of March, just a few days later, there were less than 70 flights, and they've gradually been building up. 136 the next day, 214 the following day. Let's bring us all the way up to speed. Yesterday, the 10th of March, Emirates operated 309 flights. Interestingly, that was less than the day before. Fewer flights than the day before, 326 on the 9th of March. So 309 when they would typically be operating closer to 550. Emirates definitely well on its way, but still, you know, missing 200 or so flights that it would ordinarily be operating on A380s, remember? And A380s and the capacity of the A380, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of seats, in excess of 400 seats. It's a very different picture for the other carriers. Etihad, just before the crisis, were flying about 325 flights a day. Yesterday, Etihad flew 56 flights only. Qatar were flying close to 600 flights per day just before the crisis. On the 27th of February, they had flown 583 flights. Yesterday, it was just 66. But this is the nature of airspace restrictions in the region, because there are, you know, the, if you look at the map of airspace, and I encourage all listeners to do this, it's not as equally distributed as you may think. And Bahrain has a disproportionately large airspace for such a small country. And that's having implications for all Gulf carriers there. And there are still airspace restrictions with Qatar and Qatar's airspace by the QCA, the Civil Aviation Authority, by the same Civil Aviation Authority for the UAE, which is restricting movements because of the risk to safety. That's affecting Fly Dubai Ops, Air Arabia. So I guess the message here is that we're not out of the woods, not anywhere near. And with that, each individual passenger has to make up their mind as to how they want to approach their potential or current bookings over this next period, and also going forward with the rest of the year.
The interesting thing is that I've seen Emirates tweet that if you have, let's say, a ticket from Bangkok to London, you can technically still take that, assuming they rebook you, because they're operating enough flights that they will connect you from Bangkok to London, but you might have a longer layover. And from what I see on social media, a lot of these flights are completely empty, because obviously people are taking them up on cancellation offers and stuff like that. But theoretically with Emirates, it's not, you might not get stranded, given that they are offering passengers with confirmed tickets, not just to and from Dubai, but through Dubai, where both flights are not canceled. So they're clearly going to operate. They do allow you to take those still, which that is definitely a case where it's everyone's individual judgment whether they want to do that or not.
Absolutely. And airlines are having to get creative, right? So if you pull up Flight Radar, and I know many of our listeners live on Flight Radar like us, you'll see many airlines are operating outside of their normal schedule in order to pick up business and to repatriate and reaccommodate. So yesterday you will have seen that there were Qatar flights flying from Bangkok to Europe without stopping the Middle East. So these were Qatar flights that are getting people out of Bangkok, where there is a lot of passengers stranded, and they're moving them to places like Paris, where they were booked to originally go to, and they had obtained the relevant permissions, because you can't just do this in a normal scenario, but because of the war, they'd been able to obtain the different permits to be able to fly those passengers non-stop from Bangkok to Paris. Now, in an ordinary world, that's definitely something that the Europeans wouldn't be accepting of, in terms of they would cite competition, fairness and whatnot. You would have to go via the airline's hub. These are hub and spoke carriers. But it's war and there are passengers displaced, and therefore airlines are getting creative in order to ensure that they can repatriate their customers as is necessary. There are also other examples of this. There was a Kathmandu to London flight operated by Qatar Airways as well. And again, these are really interesting routes that we would otherwise never see.
But we also kind of wish always existed, right? That would be cool.
Well, it reminds me of COVID, right? When airlines were flying anywhere and everywhere to pick up demand, and governments were thanking them left, right, and center. So all bets are off in these scenarios, as you have. Just imagine, there are so many examples of cruises. There are cruise ships everywhere that otherwise their passengers were ready to fly via these Gulf hubs back home, and that's now not an option. And so they remain on the cruise until the airline can accommodate re-accommodate those passengers. How do you do that for thousands and thousands of passengers on one cruise, remembering that all those hundreds of thousands of seats that would ordinarily be available are now no longer available, pushing up crazy demand to the few carriers who are financially loving this crisis, right? The Southeast Asian carriers and so on. And actually, let's move into that.
I think it's interesting. We've seen some statements from Thai Airways, from Air New Zealand, and Qantas have been very vocal about needing to raise prices due to increasing fuel costs. But what they're leaving out is that their ticket prices are probably more than making up for that. If someone needs to go to Australia, they have way more limited options now. So of course, these airlines that are quote unquote needing to raise prices, rising fuel costs is a valid explanation for that. But more so, I think it's just increasing demand. Another aspect to this is some other airlines that are definitely benefiting, that always benefit in situations of turbulence and uncertainty, is of course the charter operators, the airlines that are called in by different governments, for example, to operate repatriation flights. So not only the likes of Qatar Airways are doing that, but all over the Swedish media, my family was talking about how the Swedish government arranged a repatriation flight for specifically families in Dubai who needed to get home with kids. So they sent an A320. I think it was in the either Smart Wings or Czech Airlines livery from DWC, Dubai World Central, to Hurghada, to Stockholm, landing around 5 in the morning. And there was a huge sort of scandal around this because obviously each government has a different approach to trying to repatriate their citizens. Some, like the US, say get out of there and of course do absolutely nothing to help people. Then there's the UK, Germany, France, which have been sending repatriation flights. I know there have been quite a few flights to Muscat taking Brits home, where
Muscat has emerged as the hub of escape, right?
Exactly. Especially from the UAE, of course. Those airline or those countries were asking their citizens who wanted to go back to their native countries to pay a quite usual economy class fare for their tickets. But then we have certain countries, ironically, some of the highest tax countries like Sweden and Finland, asking their citizens to pay extraordinary amounts. If I'm not mistaken, I read that Finland quoted the highest amounts, 2,300 euros per ticket for citizens that wanted to fly home on a government repatriation flight operated by Finnair, which I thought was quite extreme. Sweden, this I know for a fact, was charging, actually, let me see the current conversion to make sure, because the Swedish krona has been quite up and down. They were charging 1,100 euros for an A320 flight to get families home per person. And not only were they, you know, asking people, oh, you can pay by credit card or we'll send you an invoice, They said, you need to digitally send us money from your digital wallets to this random number before you show up at the airport in order to get your ticket. Otherwise, you won't be allowed to fly. I just found this whole situation so bizarre because I really can't imagine that that flight is costing that much per passenger on a sold out A320 to operate. And then to make the payment structure like that is also just quite strange in an emergency, in my opinion. And the representative of the Swedish government who is responsible for helping Swedish citizens who are stuck abroad, because keep in mind, a lot of people obviously got stranded in the Gulf on vacation. He basically said, yeah, there are bigger problems in the world right now than people complaining about the price of this flight, which of course there are always bigger problems in the world, but sir, you have one responsibility. This is your job to help people in a crisis. And now as soon as people criticize your actions in this situation, you just say, ah, there are bigger problems. Why are you complaining? So luckily these families were able to get home, but
that's not really in the spirit of repatriation, to be honest. Governments are supposed to step in here regardless to whether it's affecting a destination that people like to holiday at or not. It shouldn't really be part of the conversation. If you have citizens that are caught up in a scenario where they are unable to leave by normal, in any normal circumstance because of, for example, extended airspace closure, then those governments have that obligation. And it is funny, it's been a mixed picture, especially a mixed picture considering you would expect there, I mean, perhaps naively, you would have expected there to have been some kind of consistency across the EU in terms of what they were doing, because there were some countries that were flying out their citizens entirely for free. And there were some on the other extreme end of the scale, which were pricing it as if it was a commercial business class booking. In fact, sometimes in some scenarios, you can fly cheaper in an ordinary week on business class, let alone economy, than what these governments were asking for. It's also interesting, Dan, don't you think, the speed that different countries were able to work in? I note that Spain were quite fast sending their government aircraft and bringing them back to a military airbase. There are examples of Asian carriers who were doing all they could as well. Asian governments relying on Asian carriers to try and figure out a plan, and ultimately then not sending those Asian carriers into the region, but deciding to use military options instead. There are British Airways had been trying to reaccommodate anyone in the region with a BA booking, essentially telling them if you can reach Muscat, we'll take you. And that sold out in minutes, literally. I think by the time BA told me that was happening, I then got a follow-up text message about 35 minutes later saying, okay, that's now full. It's and that's not necessarily because it's been a mass exodus of residents who live there. I think people shouldn't confuse it. That's not what's happening. Most of these people that you're seeing in the kind of dramatic news reports that are relieved to have been out are either transit travelers who were caught up in the airspace closure while they were in transit, or they were there on holiday. And understandably, if they were there on holiday, it's unlikely that they signed up for the idea of an imminent conflict in the region that would affect the rest of the world too. Right.
Yeah. I saw there were so many discussions in Sweden. So I just have to quote Sweden again. But I saw some people saying things like, well, if you're vacationing 3 centimeters from an active war zone, what do you expect? Mm. And I'm just like, people have such a warped view of the Middle East still, because obviously you and I think most people listening to the podcast would think the opposite. We've always viewed, or at least for a long time, we viewed the Gulf as an extremely stable, reliable place to transfer. When things are going wrong with airspace elsewhere, the Gulf has you covered, and it's a good place to do that. So seeing people say, ha ha, you should have known all along, I find that extremely strange, not surprising. But of course, it's weird to blame anyone who is in this situation, because everyone is here involuntarily.
And that sentiment is emerging from people that, you know, don't understand or don't know the Middle East, to be honest. You can't loop in everyone into one bucket, the same way you can't do that for other regions of the earth. So I think we take that sentiment with a pinch of salt, because it's emerging from people that are not so well traveled, or perhaps, you know, it was never on their scope. So it's easy for them to just put it all in one and say the Middle East, or that's where there are wars. Well, I think, you know, look a little bit closer to home and the type of things that are happening in the United States over the last few months, and then it puts things into perspective, right? So I don't think too much attention should be given to that. The oil concerns and what this is doing for airlines means that this is definitely going to be a defining event, as they call them, for airlines going forward. And I also see governments already hinting about how inflation is going to go up, or has already started to tick up, and this is going to affect the price of food and gas and so on, as is inevitable. But also that's going to be weaponized. I think, should we start a timer? When are we having Michael O'Leary come forward and tell us how some affairs are going to be higher than ever before because of fill in the blank, right?
Precisely.
We always say that, and that's inevitable. Well, but also, if he does come forward and say that, he's telling the truth this time around, at least, because fuel is an airline's number one overhead in terms of operational costs, and fuel is fluctuating all over the place right now because of the way that this conflict is unfolding, and no clear pathway forward yet as to, you know, when there is going to be stability, first and foremost for the people who deserve the stability, and that's the people everywhere across the region, including, of course, in Iran, where there are some, you know, all the footage that's coming out there, including the military personnel of the United States who are sadly, you know, many of them have been killed already. And is that a war that the US signed up for? This is a whole other conversation, I know. But first and foremost, stability for them, and then later stability for the markets, hopefully. Should we do some quick questions? At least I'll join you for the first couple, and then I might have to leave you to take the remaining as I have a broadcast beginning shortly. But let's try and get to as many as we can.
All right, let's jump into Q&A. We're actually going to go off a few comments here on YouTube from last week. Sarah says, "Hi guys, I'm flying to Seoul on the 4th of April from Manchester with a day transit in Doha on Qatar Airways, returning from Seoul to Manchester with a one-day transit on the way back. Traveling alone with my 10-year-old daughter and need help trying to figure out how best to proceed. Have booked with a third party but cannot access them due to a high number of calls they must be experiencing. What should I do? I have hardly any leniency in travel dates as I'm a teacher and this will be Easter break for me. Thank you in advance for helping me out." Oh, that's tough.
Yeah.
We're so sorry to hear about this, Sarah. I think that for the future, although this is not helpful now, this is one of the reasons we always recommend booking directly with the airline, because third parties, although they can be cheaper, as soon as anything goes wrong, it makes things more difficult. But if you can, I would, well, what do you say, Alex?
Yeah, this is definitely the complexity with booking with third party, of course, but they do have that obligation. It's incredibly difficult, as you note, that because you're a teacher, this is going to be an Easter break. I would try to get in contact with the company that you had booked with to see what your options are. Those dates currently are not covered by the flexible booking policy of today, but this is changing hour by hour. And so they may be soon. You may be able to, for example, take a credit note or something like that. But again, it depends on who you had booked with. The other scenario is that they may cancel this in advance, but it's a bit too early for that now. And then you would have that scenario that we had mentioned regarding you being able to get rerouted. It's a difficult one, and there is that added complication because of the fact that you didn't book direct. But keep us updated. Send us another message if you are still struggling to get hold of anyone with the company that you'd booked with, and we'll see what we can do to try to help there. There are a few other scenarios, some questions that we've had that are of a similar sentiment, which I think we've covered in the episode about what to do. James here is asking if we think that this is going to lead to other airlines continuing to keep their prices high and justifying it as an extended increased demand. Potentially, that is the case. Right now, prices and fares have shot up because all of that demand is now redeployed to airlines that simply don't have enough capacity to meet that demand, right? Because you've removed all of the Gulf carriers, and therefore you know, Singapore Airlines, for example, isn't able to reaccommodate everyone. So that's why fares are really high. But that's, you know, that could really continue, especially if we have big corporate decisions from the giant corps that say that actually they don't want their staff to be sent via the Middle East, just in case there is no clear end, and in case there is always that chance of what happened, and therefore they might introduce policies that route them via Asia. And if that sentiment picks up, even if not in real bookings, but if that sentiment picks up, then that's definitely going to keep fare prices high. Anyone with a booking that is unsure of what to do, and it's their bookings are for April, May, June, July, and so on, or let's say from May onwards, let's take it one day at a time, is what I always say to Dan as well, because this is an incredibly fluid, evolving situation, and there is very little known even to the senior management of airlines at the moment, let alone in what they're able to communicate to passengers. So we keep an open mind, we take it day by day, and also, you know, feel free to continue to check in with us if we can support in any way. You can contact us on our Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex.
Yeah, very well said. I have a question here from Diogo, who just shares something that happened to him. I think this is a positive conclusion. He says, "Hi, Dan and Alex, love the podcast. On the aviation topic of the week and how this war was about to ruin my holidays, in brackets, quite selfish of me, I know, but I was looking forward to this for the past months." He says, "I live in the Netherlands and I'm now in Malaysia. Arrived yesterday on a direct flight with KLM. My return flight, however, is in 2 weeks with Etihad. After watching Dan's last video, I thought about canceling the entire trip and going somewhere else, maybe in the Americas. Instead, after much consideration and an entire evening on Google Flights, I decided to book another return flight through China. So now I'm going back home with Air China instead of Etihad and landing in Frankfurt instead of Amsterdam, but at least I get to go on holidays and I'm loving KL so far." Kuala Lumpur, not KLM, this is. "Hope you guys are well, stay safe." So there you go. Planning early, trying to find a solution before you even go on the trip, like Diogo did, I think is a great idea. And now he can enjoy his trip knowing that in all likelihood, his return will go well. So I think that was good. Here we have a message from Claire, who says, "Hi, Dan and Alex. I'm flying Emirates from Australia to London in early May for a bucket list trip. My instincts tell me to sit tight and wait and see. Can I assume by then that Emirates will have found other routes, as they don't want to be losing millions of dollars for months? Thanks, Claire." This is really, really tough. It's impossible to predict what will happen, obviously. I doubt that Emirates will be setting up another sort of hub. Like we've seen Gulf Air announce they're going to operate certain flights out of Dammam, Saudi Arabia. Obviously, we had Qatar Airways, as Alex said, operating some direct flights to Europe from Bangkok. But I do have a hard time envisioning this as a long-term solution. I think Emirates might be operating in a similar way they do now. They want to restore 100% of their destinations soon. So theoretically, as we also mentioned earlier, you will probably be able to fly Emirates regardless of whether the war is over or not. The question is if you want to and if you feel safe doing that. So if I were you, I would check if there's any refundable options, either maybe with points or if you can find a fare where it's relatively cheap to cancel. I know that sites like trip.com, sometimes like you add free cancellation for an extra $50 or $100. So you can book a backup ticket. I think that might be worth it just for peace of mind. So you can go ahead and plan the trip and know that whatever the airline you end up going there on, you have two options and you'll end up canceling one of those tickets. I hope that helps, Claire. Here's a message from Tashan, who says, great podcast episode on the current situation. Interesting to note about the safety in the air versus on the ground. I myself was stuck in Dubai for 2 days longer than expected, in brackets, not the worst situation, en route to Colombo. However, I got a Fly Dubai rebooked flight, and at that point, my only worry was the fact I was on a 737 MAX. Okay, in that case, your worries are not too bad. That is funny, though. But yeah, we can trust the 737 MAX these days, I would say. Another story here from Matthias from Sweden, who reached out, saying, long-time listener, I've listened since the very first episode, and it's always enjoyable. Thanks for finally reaching out. I reached out regarding the topic you mentioned about the flight disruptions in the Middle East. I was directly affected by this as I was booked to fly home to Sweden on Qatar on March 3rd. Anyway, when I saw things deteriorate in the Middle East, I immediately started looking for other options going back from Kuala Lumpur. On the 1st of March, early morning KL time, I had already booked another return ticket via Hong Kong and Helsinki on Cathay and Finnair. As the time of writing, March 10th, I'm currently completing the last leg of this booking. I guess booking somewhat early, I managed to snag my one-way ticket for 10,000 crowns, or about $1,100. QR was very fast to issue refund for my original booking once I requested it, no questions asked. So again, fast action, finding solutions is really the way to go here. I'm so glad to hear the refund went well and that was efficient. And I know that Alex will agree with that. And finally, here, one last question from Ben for today. He says, for airline staff traveling standby from Australia to Europe, where you only get on if there is an empty seat, what routing usually gives the best odds as a solo traveler? Most people go via big Middle Eastern or Asian hubs. With the current situation in the Middle East and political airspace disruptions, would it actually be smarter to route somewhere less conventional like the US or even South America? I'm thinking a few months ahead. Does that change the standby strategy in terms of load factors and hub connections? Okay, so obviously Alex and I are no experts at this, and we can't say specifically where you'll get good airline standby, but what we can say is that it doesn't sound like a bad idea to try to do it through the US. In my personal experience from what I've seen, it does not look like the US carriers are always sold out on their Oceania flights, especially to New Zealand. I've seen a lot of available seats on United. I think Australia could be the same case. So if you can get up to the US, obviously you have countless options to get to Europe, and they will not be nearly as affected as the rest of the world by what's going on in the Middle East. So that might be good to look at. South America seems like a bit of a unnecessary detour, considering that there are way fewer flights between Oceania and South America, than between South America and Europe. So my tip would be to check through North America if you can. I'm sure the flights from Asia will unfortunately be pretty sold out. So with that, guys, we have literally never received this many DMs or questions in a week. We will try to do as many as possible next week as well, because as much as we hope this will be resolved in 7 days, I don't exactly know if it will. But until then, as always, thank you for tuning in. We so appreciate you, and we will see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
Keep safe, everyone. See you soon.